This was Leland Shields, February 7th, 2014. Zen Koans as Myths Reflecting Individuation. This was recorded on DVD. There were a few images in this talk, and they are on the DVD in the library at the Jung Society.
So, Leland Shields, our speaker tonight, is a member of the Seattle community, very active with JPA. He's in private practice in psychotherapy, and his work draws not only from Jung, but also mindfulness, meditation, and nonviolent communication. One interesting fact I learned about Leland when I was reading today is that some time ago he was an engineering consultant and researcher on failure analysis. No doubt that influenced his interest in complexity theory. So his publications include Dreamwork, Around the World, and Across Time. He also has written Koans as Myths Reflecting Individuation, and that's the topic for him this lecture tonight. Also, 12 Ideas About Handling Workplace Conflict, 9 Ideas About Managing Workplace Stress, Finding Freedom in the Midst of Pain, Finding a Teacher in the Real World, and this one, fascinating title, Healing from Experiences with Unhealthy Spiritual Groups and Cults. Treatment Using Myths and Folk Tales, written with Jerry Carter. So join me in welcoming Leland Shields.
Thank you. I'd like to express my appreciation to the Jung Society for having me tonight, and for all of you for braving this cold night for coming out here. I'd also like to, just before I start, thank some colleagues and friends who commented for me and gave me some suggestions about what I'm going to say tonight. And I appreciate all the help I can get, actually. So the topic tonight, as we've heard, is Zen Koans as Myths of Individuation, a topic that I deeply enjoy myself, and one where I hope quickly to get to some stories to warm us all up with the stories, which I think are really the meat of this. But before we do, I want to make sure we have vocabulary in common. Maybe I should ask, are there folks here who are from the Zen side who aren't familiar with individuation? Maybe a couple of folks. I presume the rest are from the Jungian side who have good definitions of individuation, even if not so the koans. Maybe I should check that. Does everybody have an idea of that word individuation as Jung used it? Okay. Before I rush on from this. So I'll go quickly through a couple of definitions. Then I want to jump as quickly as I can into the story of Muzhou and Yunmen and talk about how it's a story from ancient China, but it's also a story that's here with us tonight. It's about how we're each interacting here tonight and how we each have a choice here tonight on how it is we find our genuine response. And then I hope to get to some more stories to illuminate the topic a little further. So since most of us are familiar with this, I'm just going to read through Jung's definition, put us on the same page, and not take a lot of time with this. But there is a destination, a possible goal, beyond the alienations of self. That is the way of individuation. Individuation means becoming a single, homogeneous being, and insofar as individuality embraces our innermost, last, and incomparable uniqueness. It also implies becoming one's own self. We could therefore translate individuation as coming to selfhood or self-realization. Now let me move to the Zen side of this talk and the koans themselves. For some background, at the most fundamental, koans are stories of what we're told are real encounters between Zen practitioners, often students and teachers, often stories of the practice of these individuals, in the story, in their means of finding their most genuine responses. These stories, the earliest ones were transmitted orally, Then later on, they got to be written down. There's stories from India, from China, from Japan. And they're collected in books that are translated into English and languages and used around the world today, that are intended to help us to open our own way into this great matter. And they're used worldwide. And as they're in use today, they're often presented one-on-one between a student and a teacher. The teacher offers the koan to the student, and the student responds with an appropriate presentation. The intention is a direct experience, not an intellectual exploration, not necessarily something to think about or figure out, but find, what is my direct experience of this, and how do I express it? Though the distillation of what it is that I have as an expression, that may take some time. This is a quote of Robert Eakin Roshi. He was what I think of as one of the grandfathers of American Zen. He was the teacher at the Diamond Sangha in Honolulu before he died not too many years ago. And he had translated and commented on one of the books of koans, of Wu Men Quan. And in it he says, through this process of koan study, we discover that life and death are the same as no life and no death. The other is no other than myself. Each being is infinitely precious as a unique expression of the nature which is essential to us all. So no small matter that he's talking about, and yet, just right here also. But are they myths? That's something that I'm going to be relying on tonight, because I'm going to tell these koans not as they're used in Zen tradition, but I'm going to talk about them more in the style that we might talk about folk tales, give them in a paraphrased style. And Jung had talked about myths as being integral to all religions. And he talked about as if clearly so was the kind of language he used in talking about it. And I would submit that koans as myths are archetypal stories, if by no other means we can tell by their resonance across 1,000 years and thousands of miles to get to where we are today and still holding meaning for us. Clearly, koans are also culturally set, but I find them relevant now, and I'll let you see for yourself as we go into the first story. So this is a story of Mujo and Yunmen. And I'm going to tell it twice. The first time I'll tell it in the kind of concise style of a koan, without a lot of elaboration. And then I'm going to tell it again with the folk tale style of bringing some body to it, of how I might see what was happening between some of the scenes in the koan. So in the story of Mujo and Yunmen, Yunmen is on pilgrimage, and as he's walking by an area, he realizes he's passing by the hut of the hermit Mujo. He decides to stop and see what Mujo has got to say. He knocks on the door. Mujo says, "Come in." Yunmen opens the door, and as soon as he enters, Mujo grabs him by the collar and yells, "Speak! Speak!" Yunmen hesitates. So Mujo throws him out, slams the door. Yunmen tries again, he knocks on the door. Again, Mujo grabs him as soon as he enters, demands that he speak, and throws him out. A third time this happens to the same end. But this time, as Yunmen is going out the door, he puts out his leg. And when he puts out his leg, Mujo slams the door. It doesn't say whether Mujo saw the leg or not. He hits the leg, and in some translations says breaks it. Yunmen screams in pain. And then in the story of the koan, in that moment, has great realization, and Mujo opens the door and welcomes him in. So that's the koan. Now let me back up to how do we understand this? So So I picture Yunmen. He's on his pilgrimage. He's probably, it takes some nerve to knock on the door of the stranger to see what he's got to say. But he's perhaps a little casual about it on this first round. And he, but as soon as he enters in, this man grabs him by the collar and yells, "Speak, speak!" Of course he hesitates. Wouldn't we all? We don't have any context for what this question's about. Speak about what? And he's thrown out, standing outside, and now he's got his first choice. He can say, "This guy's a jerk," and just walk down the road. Or in this case, he stayed around. So we must believe that there was something in this exchange that Yunmen had to think, okay, maybe he's a jerk, but maybe there's something more. There's some, I'm picturing there's got to be a discord in Yunmen that he's not happy with this interaction. He needs to try this again. So he goes back and tries it a second time. No better. He tries it a third time. No better. But now when he puts his leg out, this is, now he's got literally skin in the game. Now he's really put his vulnerability out there. I want to know what's going on here. I'm picturing too that between these times, he's not just wandering around, but he's got to stop and consider, what's this about? He may be doing his own meditation between each of these. Really sitting with this. What's going on here? What does this guy want? What's my hesitation? How do I find it? How do I find my response to this man? But then, when he feels the pain in his leg, no separation anymore between Yunmen and a response. It's just, ah! Just the pain, just the response. Fully genuine. Fully authentic in that moment. We might say, too, the broken leg, if I might push it a little, maybe you could say, it's also representing something had to break in Yunmen for him to give this genuine response. Perhaps his concept of himself, it's not relevant anymore when he's just responding. So there's the first story. Maybe before I say more, let me open up the floor to see if anybody got any questions so far, or comments. Any thoughts about this story? Does it strike you? Do you feel it yourself? Because remember, we're talking here, this is about individuation we're talking about finding a genuine response. What I'd like to present is that it's not individuation somewhere else for someone else. It's each of us, too. Each of us are Yunmen, being grabbed by each encounter to say, what's my response? Do I have one now? Do I have something to say? Or is silence my response? Yeah.
Well, I'll just say it takes me into my day that I had today, and it makes me reflect back where I had some responses that I need to go back to. I need to knock on the door again. It's just it's a great reminder. And it's a great reflection tool.
Thank you. Anyone else have a comment at this point? Okay. So what can we say about this story now? Just as Jan was bringing out here, it's not just in ancient China. We're talking about everyday experiences here and making that conscious engagement, engaging in what it is I have to express in this moment to this person. One of the things I love about this story, too, is it's also a microcosm of koan study. It really is a match to what happens in that room where the teacher gives a koan and the student walks away and says, what does this guy want? What does this woman want? and works on it and comes back again to distill and refine and find, where do I even look? Some of the first questions I hear about people taking on koans is, how do I even do it? Am I trying to figure something out? What am I doing in meditation with this story? But an important step is engaging with it, that this is my question. Like Yunmen stayed. I'd also see in this that it's the archetype of the process of individuation. Where Yunmen here is challenged to find what is his response. And we might make parallels to the story of some other ancient stories like Jesus in the desert is grabbed by Satan and tested with three questions. Buddha sits down under the Bodhi tree and Mara comes and tests him, challenges him. And he had his responses. And we might see, too, that in each of those two stories, those are the dramatic parts of the story, but in the moment before, Jesus engaged to choose to go to the desert for his reflection. And Buddha said, I'm not chasing my tail anymore. I'm going to sit here until I know. And that put him in the sights of Mara. But both these stories are too distant. So let me bring up another one. I'm going to use a movie clip to show a more sort of big life question example of it. So in this moment, I just wanted to use a small one, a personal one. There was a time several years ago when I had a couple come into my office. It was the first time I met them. And this couple was clearly in great distress right away. They just jumped right into a huge argument between them. And there's a substance abuse problem for one of the two. And the woman with the substance abuse problem had talked the man into coming in, though clearly he was 1 foot out the door. And as try as I might through this session, I was not getting any ground in either of them opening up a different way to think about, look at, talk to each other. They were just entrenched, both of them. And as the hour went on, I found myself getting a little agitated, a little more and a little more. I'm watching the clock, and there's 10 or 15 minutes left. And I'm just getting more agitated, thinking, this couple's going to break up right here in front of me. And then, for some reason that I could not explain, it just stopped. And I recognized in that moment that, wait a minute, what's going on here? I don't have to solve this. And I didn't think about it right, I didn't think about why right away, but later what I reflected on is there's a whole undercurrent going on for me of I want to be of value to these people. So I need them to do something better. And therefore I'm getting agitated. I want to prove my worth here. And I'll be damned if these people are going to break up in my office. At least not the first time I see them. But once I recognized that and could let it go, then I could be free. Then I could see what my real options were. I could give up that limited view. And then there were a world of options, and I could easily say, well, you know, it looks to me like if you want to walk out with the same views you came in with, this relationship will not last long. And that's up to you. But if you want something different, now is a time where you can look at each other and see, where is there a place to shift here? How can you listen to each other differently? Can you talk to each other differently? Is there something you want to do? It's up to you to find, what are you going to shift? And they did. They found one of them was now willing to shift, the other, then I could turn to the other one and say, all right, you better ask her ask him what it is he wants, or you're not getting anywhere here, and see if that's something you can do. But the whole energy in the room shifted when I saw that we were all just pushing the same direction. And then we could talk about what's really going on. But to me, that the experience I felt was a vivid one of this one we're talking about, as a genuine response of finding that my own vulnerability to say, I cared what happened with these people. I cared how they saw me. I cared how I appeared. When I could release that, then I was free. And before going on from this slide, too, I'll just mention a couple other examples that have been in the news in the last year that impressed me. And that was Angelina Jolie choosing to write publicly about having mastectomies, thinking this was her willingness to be genuine to the public, even though it was contrary to her image as a film star. And similarly, Jason Collins, an NFL player, willing to come out publicly as gay. So some of this I think I've talked about already, that it's about me and you tonight, that this subject, that's what's really important to me about this subject. And that I'm using these stories more in the Jungian sense than we would be in the koan study in the Zen tradition. But also just wanted to mention, I'm hoping to get to this by the end too, in Zen tradition, and I believe in Jungian tradition too, there is what we're looking for is a perspective beyond the conceptual. So not just what do we take of this and how do we form ideas about it, but something on a deeper level. And I'm not going to go into detail at this point too about these two words of shadow in the Jungian side and no self in the Zen side. I find there to be an overlap, not an equality between them, but an overlap. And the reason it's important, especially for Zen folks, is all this talk about the self can be problematic on account of we don't have one. So we have to be a little careful. But I'll just ask to watch a little bit. Where can you find a validity in both the no-self and see if you see a correspondence with a shadow as we go? And I also want to just say, I want to use this story and maybe some others to look specifically, too, at how do we decide? How do we decide when we feel something's grabbed us? When I walk away and say, I did not respond in that situation with my full and genuine self. There's something, I feel a discord. How do we then find that response? And this is one, too, that's important to me because I see it come up all the time in the therapy room. I see it come up when a person is so used to taking care of others that if I say, well, what do you want? I'll frequently hear, I don't know. That's one way it shows up. But all those times when we're not finding, we don't even know where to look, I don't know how to do it. In these stories, I find they're a map to that. The distilling response to be just this, finding it here. This is a cartoon from a New Yorker magazine that where here's a big sign for pointing to the truth, and then there's that little one that I think thought of as really talking about the same thing we're talking about here. How do you choose the message? And here it is in a mainstream publication. So I thought, this is not just for our little slice of the Jungian world. Everybody has a stake in this. To really recognize that direct experience part, I was going to ask if you would indulge me for just a few minutes to do a little mindful listening. I brought a bell. I'll try to ring this in a way it's not going to overload the microphones. But all I'm going to ask is that you take a moment to just listen Let the sound come to you. No way, no way to do it right or wrong. Just take the time and listen to the sound of the bell. Make yourself comfortable. I'm going to give it a couple minutes. You can also listen to some of the other ambient sounds. If your mind wanders, it's okay. Don't think twice. Just come back. Just listen. One more. Thank you. Now I want to go back to that same story and break it down into some steps. There may be other ways to look at it, but just to find one useful way to notice some specific parts of it. And I'm going to go through each of these in more detail, but just to give you the flow of it here, the five steps I'm calling out here are receiving the call, that hesitation, accepting the call, engaging in it, trying again, don't give up, taking a risk, and then an intimate response. So for receiving the call, we know Yunmen hesitated. His hesitation is not good and not bad. It's human. It's where our humanity comes through. That's a vulnerability too. We have reasons for being protective. That's not a bad thing at all. But it's good to know, how does that look for us? How does it look for you? And I find there to be some great examples of this in comedy, in this idea of the grabbing too. Let me just read one piece. This is from David Sedaris. As we pulled into the station, I recalled an afternoon 10 years earlier. I'd been riding the Chicago L with my sister, Amy, who was getting off 2 or 3 stops ahead of me. The doors opened, and as she stepped out of the crowded car, she turned around to yell, "So long, David. Good luck beating that rape charge." Everyone on board had turned to stare at me. Some seemed curious, some frightened, but the overwhelming majority appeared to hate me with a ferocity I had never before encountered. "That's my sister," I said. "She likes to joke around." I laughed and smiled, but it did no good. Every gesture made me appear more guilty, and I wound up getting off at the next stop, rather than continuing to ride alongside people who thought of me as a rapist. So there's a call that he's working out in his comedy, right? And then here's another one from a Caulfield comic. I don't know if you can read it from where you are, so I'll read it out. The teacher: "Nice report, Caulfield. You actually read the book. It wasn't easy. Boring." Teacher: "Remember, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration." Here's Caulfield talking to the janitor: "I did not question her experience with either, so thanks for the advice on the on-deck circle in my brain." And then the janitor says, "No sweat." So again, that's a call. I have a choice to say something to this teacher or not. Inspiration, perspiration, you're giving me the best straight line of the day. Do I take it? Now let me play a clip out of Good Will Hunting. Are people familiar with this movie? I love this movie. This clip that we're about to see is one I remembered and thought it would be particularly appropriate to this topic. And I rewatched the movie this week and was really knocked out all over again by this movie. I had in mind this one area of it and realized I could have picked four or five more, which really said something to me. But just to give a little background of it, in case anybody isn't familiar with it. In this clip, Robin Williams is a psychologist. And he's meeting for the first time with Will, who's played by Matt Damon. Matt Damon is a math genius of untold proportions. But he grew up being beaten and from foster home to foster home and has been arrested and put in jail. And one of the contingencies on his staying out of jail is that he go meet with this MIT math professor, a Nobel laureate, and this is now and a therapist, and this is his, I think, fifth try, where he's managed to get under the skin of everyone so far. So here they are.
Where are you from in Southie?
I like what you've done with the place.
Oh, thanks.
Do you buy all these books retail, or do you send away for like a shrink kit that comes with all these volumes included?
Do you like books?
Yeah.
Do you read any of these books?
I don't know.
How about any of these books?
Probably not.
What about the ones on the top shelf? You read those?
Yeah, I read those.
Good for you. What do you think about them?
Hey, I'm not here for a fucking book report. They're your books. Why don't you read them?
I did. I had to.
That must have taken you a long time.
Yeah, it did.
United States of America, A Complete History, Volume 1. Jesus. You want to read a real history book, read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. That book will fucking knock you on your ass.
Better than Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent? You think that's a good book?
Fucking people baffle me. Spend all your money on these fucking fancy books. You surround yourselves with them. They're the wrong fucking books.
What are the right fucking books, Will?
Hey, whatever blows your hair back.
Yeah. Haven't got much hair left. Hey, you know you'd be better off shoving that cigarette up your ass. It'd probably be healthier for you.
Yeah, I know. It really gets in the way of my yoga.
You work out, huh?
What, you lift?
Yeah.
Yeah, Nautilus?
No, free weights.
Oh, really? Free weights, huh?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah?
Just like that.
What do you bench?
285. What do you bench?
You paint that?
Yeah. You paint?
Mm-mm.
Do you sculpt?
No.
You like art? You like music?
It's a real piece of shit.
Oh, well, tell me what you really think.
Oh, I'm just the linear and
impressionistic mix makes a very muddled composition. It's also a Winslow Homer ripoff, except you got Whitey rowing the boat there.
Well, that's odd one, eh? It wasn't very good.
That's not really what concerns me, though.
What concerns you?
It's the coloring.
You know what the real bitch of it is? It's paint by number.
Is it color by number? Because the colors are fascinating to me.
Are they really? What about that?
I think you're about one step away from cutting your fucking hair off.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I think I should move to the south of France, change my name to Vincent.
You ever heard the saying, any port in a storm?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that means you.
In what way?
Maybe you're in the middle of a storm, a big fucking storm.
Yeah.
The sky's falling on your head, the waves are crashing over your little boat, the oars are about to snap. You're just pissing your pants, you're crying for the harbor, so maybe you do what you gotta do to get out. You know, maybe you became a psychologist.
Bingo. That's it. Let me do my job now. You start with me. Come on.
Maybe you married the wrong woman.
Maybe you should watch your mouth.
Watch it right there, Chief, all right? Well, that's it, isn't it? You married the wrong woman? What happened? Why'd she leave you? Was she, you know, banging some other guy?
If you ever disrespect my wife again, I will end you. I will fucking end you. Got that, Chief?
Time's up.
At ease, gentlemen. Okay.
I'll understand if you don't want to meet with me again. Thursday, 4 o'clock. Make sure the kid's here.
Yeah. Thanks.
Any thoughts? Quite the call, isn't it? You saw Robin Williams' first response, grab him by the throat. The part I didn't remember until going back to watch it again was that Robin Williams also, Sean is the character name here, immediately said, Thursday, 4 o'clock. He accepted the call. He said yes. Something called him. Anyone want to comment on this?
So he seems to want the student back, even though the student is confronting him. He's not really confronting the student. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is confronting the student, of course, but the student's drawing something out of him. And at first he wants to push it away, naturally, but then he quickly realizes that's the source of their growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was working hard there, too,
yeah.
To say, music, you like anything? Anyone else but Matt Damon's character, who Will, would have backed off with the first responses to the wife, too. But not him. Anyone else? Yeah.
Yeah, my association is the Modern Love column in the New York Times this week was by the guy who's going to speak Monday night at Hugo House, and he takes relationship into three categories. Sneakers, squashers and explorers. And it seems like the question there that was being played out, were they going to sneak? So was something going to be snuck over or snuck through? And his impulse was to squash it. And then they decided to have an exploration.
Hmm. Interesting. That's a nice lens. Yes.
Reaction. When he reacts to what he says, you know, about his wife. I mean, all of a sudden it was just human and real. So there's something that's really, that to me is where the shift is.
Uh-huh.
Something really, because it just becomes, he becomes human. I mean, and it's registered in Matt Damon's character as well.
Yeah, he didn't miss it, did he?
Yeah. And this is very different than what he's been experiencing, because I, you know, I've seen the movie too. And that about that human.
The vulnerability showed through.
Right.
Yeah, in the back.
I was thinking about what a risky move it was for the counselor to take on such a challenging client, because he's obviously quite bright, and even though it seems like the Rob Williams character must be pretty confident and probably pretty good, because the math professor sought him out to take his client, but to meet someone with such brilliance, he really was willing to risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I getting this right that Robin Williams grabbed Matt Damon for it became experiential rather than intellectual?
Experiential rather than what?
Intellectual. Is that shift to?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, he might say too, he got to be an automatic response.
Yeah.
At that point too. Question is it one he likes or not? And we'll see that in a moment. Yeah.
Well, so just going back to the poem about feeling his leg broken.
Uh-huh.
So as I'm watching this, I'm thinking, well, whose leg is getting broken?
Oh, yeah. Good question. Good question. What do you think?
Both. I think they're both getting their leg broken in some way to help a direct experience, a genuine contact.
Mm, that's good.
And add the further sense of who's calling who.
Uh-huh.
Who's making the call here?
Uh-huh.
Because it seemed like there were two calls going on.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there are always two calls. Mm-hmm. Let's take it. Oh, go ahead.
I have one more thing looking at this. And I don't know whether it's the bleed through from the next shot. It seemed like the next shot was bleeding through. But when I look at this, it looks like there's a little boat to the left with a person with a hat and a flag in the background and a keg in the front. And I'm just, having heard James Foley talk about emotional impact recently in terms of what they try to load in, whether that bled was there intentionally or is there, I don't know. But it's just kind of wild to watch.
Interesting. Okay, let's take it a little further, and then I'll play you some more of Good Will Hunting. So just as Yuen-Min stayed around, what we're talking about is Robin Williams staying around, and Will is. And what's the alternative you might think of, too, is to be satisfied with something a little less. We could deaden or we could go into this discomfort. We could just think the other person is the problem, or we could focus our attention, see what's going on. What is my response? So back to this question, so how do we work with this? How do we find what is my response? This is a quote I'm repeating far too often these days. I've just fallen in love with this quote of Erwin Schrödinger that I came across. In an honest search for knowledge, you quite often have to abide by ignorance for an indefinite period of time. And I love that for that moment when you walk away. You think, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? And starting at, I don't know. I don't know. Okay, let me play some more. I know we got to get a break in here soon. But I can't resist playing some more. You can leave the lights off. I'm going to go right into another clip. Where that clip ended, the sense I had was I couldn't tell if he was brooding or contemplating, which I'm sure was purposeful. But that's all we saw from the filmmaker. Now let's go to the next time they meet, which is also the next time we see the, Robin Williams' character.
You again, huh?
Come with me.
So what's this? The taster's choice moment between guys?
This is really nice. You got a thing for swans? Is this like a fetish? It's something like maybe we need to devote some time to?
Thought about what you said to me the other day about my painting.
Huh.
Stayed up half the night thinking about it. Something occurred to me. I fell into a deep, peaceful sleep and haven't thought about you since. You know what occurred to me?
No.
You're just a kid. You don't have the faintest idea of what you're talking about.
Why, thank you.
It's all right. You've never been out of Boston.
Nope.
So if I asked you about art, you'd probably give me the skinny on every art book ever written. Michelangelo. I know a lot about him. Life's work, political aspirations, him and the Pope, sexual orientation, the whole works, right? I bet you can't tell me what it smells like in the Sistine Chapel. You've never actually stood there and looked up at that beautiful ceiling. Seen that. If I ask you about women, you'd probably give me a syllabus of your personal favorites. You may have even been laid a few times. But you can't tell me what it feels like to wake up next to a woman and feel truly happy. You're a tough kid. I ask you about war, you'd probably throw Shakespeare at me, right? Once more into the breach, dear friends. But you've never been near one. You've never held your best friend's head in your lap and watch him gasp his last breath looking to you for help. I ask you about love, you'd probably quote me a sonnet. But you've never looked at a woman and been totally vulnerable. Known someone that could level you with her eyes. Feeling like God put an angel on earth just for you. Who could rescue you from the depths of hell. And you wouldn't know what it's like to be her angel. To have that love for her be there forever. Through anything. Through cancer. And you wouldn't know about sleeping, sitting up in a hospital room for 2 months, holding her hand. Because the doctors could see in your eyes that the terms visiting hours don't apply to you. You don't know about real loss, because that only occurs when you love something more than you love yourself. I doubt you've ever dared to love anybody that much. I look at you, I don't see an intelligent, confident man. I see a cocky, scared, shitless kid. But you're a genius, Will. No one denies that. No one could possibly understand the depths of you. But you presume to know everything about me because you saw a painting of mine. You ripped my fucking life apart. You're an orphan, right? Do you think I'd know the first thing about how hard your life has been, how you feel, who you are? Because I read Oliver Twist. Does that encapsulate you? Personally, I don't give a shit about all that, because you know what? I can't learn anything from you. I can't read in some fucking book. Unless you want to talk about you, who you are. And I'm fascinated. I'm in.
But you don't want to do that, do you, Sport? You're terrified of what you might say. Your move, Chief.
What do you think?
What was his last statement?
Your move, Chief. Yeah. That Sean got a genuine response from Will. Yeah, that's true. Other thoughts? What's that?
I didn't believe Will would be silent that way. He was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
And I think that's a valid question in terms of is realistic to the characters. The way I would take it with respect to our topic here is that with Robin Williams' authenticity, it cut through for Will and stopped him. Clearly not used to that response. Not underneath the anger, underneath defensiveness. I bet Will is really good at getting anger and defensiveness. But what about something else? And that's with this character, my hat's off to Sean here. Yeah, and he let himself get to him too, I would say. That he really let himself look deeply. Not a casual response that he came up with here. Yeah.
Could he have gotten to that place within himself if he had the experience of reaching up at the throat and reacting experientially? And then had to question, where did that come from? What is that that came out?
Yeah, you might say that's when his leg was broken by his own response. If this is not what I wanted myself, what the heck am I doing? Any other thoughts? It's going to take a break. Anything else before a break? Yeah. All the way in the back.
How many clients do you think the protagonist could endure that move?
Good question. Good question. Yeah.
I think there's something powerful with doing the unpredictable. Not just changing your reaction, but literally, they moved out of the office. It's like, let's shift this. Mm-hmm. And probably neither has done that a lot. But the choice to, and sometimes when being stuck, choosing to just shift without knowing where that's going to go.
Uh-huh. So that would really give a room for a direct experience. It's a new ground. Yeah.
He enters into the therapy with an openness and a vulnerability. He's not entering in defensive, or closed down. So then he can have these authentic reactions. And there's something about his already being open and kind of willing to be in that space that makes it different. Mm-hmm. Then, like, and then again, if you, you know, the movie, if you see the other therapist he goes to, it's so different. They're intellectual and they're coming from, you know, they're just, they're not relating, right? They're not, being moved by, you know, in that relational way.
Yeah, and not adapting.
Yeah.
To this client, to this patient. The other part of that, too, is that Sean is going for the direct experience, saying, you can't, if I read Oliver Twist, I'm not going to know you. It's not the intellectual. We're looking for something beyond concepts here, even in how we're talking. I was just going to make, oh, you go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I thought it was a really great example about, you know, you can't make somebody else be authentic, but you could really be for their authenticity. And of course, the way he was for the authenticity was very clearly pointing out his inauthenticity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just one other thing that struck me watching it, too, this time, was that, and then I slept peacefully. Isn't that a great demonstration? That a great example of how do we know we got our response? It's like, ah, I move on. One more comment.
Yeah, coincidence. Today I was looking up what the genius really is. And he used it in another way. He calls will a genius, but like in old Rome, genius was more the essence of place, the essence of person. And the more you grow as a person, you shine your genius, like Julius Caesar, before he died, they recognized him as a genius.
Huh.
So it's like self-realization, and then calling somebody a genius, but in a different way.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, why don't we take a break? How long do you usually take a break?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. It's about 5 after 8 now. Actually, before I move on, there's something that, a discussion that came up at the break that I thought I'd say something about that is an interesting point. The question was, what about the non-intellectual direct response of Sean when he grabs the neck of Will? So, and I'll tell you what I find interesting about this, because you might say that what happens in bar fights every day is a genuine response of that nature. But is it different? Is that different than the response we're looking for? Than what we're calling the response that's being sought through the process, through the pondering? What I would say about that is Sean's first response was still protective, aggressive, but protective. There was something of himself that was offended. It was his second response that was coming back with an open hand. So the difference I see there is the first response is protecting a limited self. Protecting any self is not no self in a Zen sense. Protecting a limited self is maintaining enforcement of the shadow in a Jungian sense. And there's a distinction we're looking for, a felt distinction. Sean wasn't happy with it. That's why he's home drinking until he got to that place where he could sleep like a baby. And that's the... But how he got there, that's the heart of this. We haven't really gotten to the how. I'm going to say more, we'll do more with that, have more time for that tomorrow. Yeah.
He also accesses nature. So he takes him out of the office into nature, which is leveling, and it belongs to all of us. It's not his office, it's our nature. And then he can get up and leave. And let Will speak with him. because he could have gone up from his office and left John Pavlovich sit there, but no.
Not the same. But in terms of that, I think those are great points. In terms of the how, before Will came into the room, Sean had worked that out. How did he work that out? And more importantly, how do I work that out? How do you work that out? What happens? What's your process? How do you do it your way? That's really what we're looking for here, in individuation and in Zen practice. Yeah. Pardon me? Good luck. Yeah, there may be a night that works. Maybe a second night. Any other comments? Yeah.
I was thinking about the fact that it seemed like there's something about breaking out of roles. Right, in the Kohen, the student wants, he's actually knocking on the door because he wants the master to speak. And the master turns the tables, changes the role and insists on the student speaking.
That's a good point.
So there's sort of like a jiu-jitsu upturning of the role, a role reversal. And likewise in the movie, it seems like at first Will is sort of out therapisting the therapist.
Yeah.
Right? And then what upsets the therapist is the fact that he acts like he isn't because he's throwing this patient, which is sort of horrifying for the therapist to do. So, but then out of that, he breaks through the therapist role and becomes more authentic in the park. And he breaks out of the role by leaving the office. So there's, to be genuine or to be authentic, there has to be a breaking out of some kind of conceptualization, rote, role, or something like that. It seems that's like good. Both of these examples you've given me.
Yeah, and
one among numerous themes there.
And the symbol of the broken leg, you might say, carries that exactly the point. Yeah.
Well, just listening to what you were saying and what you're bringing out here, it makes me think of the process of individuation as sort of the willingness to show up as we are authentically. So he kind of had nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. And maybe he made that commitment to himself, like, I'm just going to go for broke here, and he can do what he wants with it. Meaning Sean saying, you know, what he said. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be that process of really showing all of it as we are.
Uh-huh. And in keeping with what you're both saying, in the first scene in the office, Will's taking over as therapist. Sean acts like Will in the movie. He grabs him by the neck. That's Will's way of behaving. That's why he was there in the first place, why he's put in jail for assault. And Will says, I think time's up for today. I mean, really nailing the coffin on that one. He won, clearly. Will won that encounter. And then he turns it around.
Not playing roles is also this sort of this. He says, it's your move, chief. In other words, we're playing a game, let's stop playing games.
Uh-huh.
Let's be real. Instead of strategically one-upping each other.
What happens next in the movie, I'll give away too, by the way. They keep meeting, and Will says nothing, session after session. And the math professor who's brought Will to Sean keeps beating up on Sean, you got to do something here. And Sean says, no way. I said, your move, chief, it's your move. No way. keeping his way of doing it. Now I'm thinking about, it's about 8:30 now. I'm going to leave sometime at the end. I've got a little film clip at the end. I'm going to skip ahead to something that's more in keeping with what we're talking about here, to another story. I think we can do it. Oh, I got to use this one on the way though. This is another koan. And what you're seeing is the whole koan. A student asked Yunmen, what are the teachings of a whole lifetime? Yunmen said an appropriate statement. And this is Yunmen later, as a teacher himself. Yunmen is known, by the way, for his poetic responses. They really just like a lid fits a box. He is beautiful. Okay, so let's do... relationships in koans, the story of Hui Neng and Ming, that also addresses this part about roles. Let me tell the koan first. Okay, in this story, Hui Neng was born in China around Tang Dynasty, I believe, to a family of some means, but his father died when he was young enough that he had to stop his schooling and old enough to go to work to support his family. So he was illiterate. And a little later in his life, when he had a little more freedom, he met someone on the street who was chanting the Diamond Sutra, the words of the Buddha. Hui Neng was so moved that he had an experience of openness, and he asked the monk, where did he study? Where did he learn this? And the monk told him, a monastery. Hui Neng crossed China from south to north and joined this monastery. But being illiterate, he couldn't join as a regular participant. He got a job in the kitchen. Some months after he had been there, the old master decided it was time for him to retire, and he needed to choose a successor. So he announced to the assembly, anyone who wants to take over my position should write a poem on the inner wall of the monastery gardens. And we'll see who writes a poem that makes the point most clearly. So the head monk, who everybody thought was the shoo-in, writes a poem. Hui Neng comes out of the kitchen one night with a buddy of his, sees something written on the wall and says, what's this? And he hears the story, and Hui Neng says, what does it say? And his buddy reads the poem to him, and Hui Neng says, that's not it. Write this for me. And he writes... he has his own poem written on the wall. The next day, the old master comes out, and he looks at the wall, and he reads the two poems. He says, who wrote these? And he's told. He said, the guy in the kitchen, send him in to see me. They spend a couple hours talking. And the old master says to Hui Neng, I'm going to give you my robes and bowl as a symbol of the transmission of the teaching from me to you. But I'm also going to suggest that you run, because I don't know what the head monk's going to do. Hui Neng takes the robe and bowl, and he runs. Sure enough, the head monk chases him down, chases him for a long time, and catches up with him. Hui Neng places the robe and bowl on a large rock and says to the head monk, his name is Ming, you could take the robes and bowls, they're not to be fought after. They're of the Dharma. So Ming goes over, and in the concise manner of koans, it says they're immovable. It doesn't say if there is a mysterious force about it or something in his own heart. But Ming then turns around and he says to Hui Ning, I didn't come for the robes and bowl. I came for the teaching. Teach me. So Hui Ning says, don't think good. Don't think evil. At this moment, what is the true face of the head monk, Ming? And with that, the story says, Ming had great satori, was trembling all over and crying, and said, I've sat with the old master all these years, and it's from you, brother, that I'm learning. You are my teacher. And Hui Ning says, let us both call Hung Mei our teacher. That's the mountain where the monastery was. And Ming says, is there anything, any more secret teachings? Hui Ning says, there's nothing secret, my brother. It's all in your own face. And then there's a line at the end. Hui Ning says something like, this is, take your understanding back and maintain it well. And that's the end of the story. So, this is one of those stories that, another one that I just love deeply for the kind of message that we've just been talking about too. As I picture Ming here, at some point in his life, he decided he's going to be a renunciant. He's going to give up an idea of being better, idea of doing what his mother wanted to be, the CEO of Starbucks. And he's just going to be a monk. But here he is, he finds himself chasing down Hui Ning. He can't feel good about this. If we give him at all the benefit of the doubt. He's the one who's literate, who's been doing this for years. His role is supposed to be the next person who runs this monastery. He's humiliated in front of all his colleagues that this guy from the south got it. And yet, in that moment, he stopped and looked at his true face. Covered with sweat and dirt from chasing him. And clearly he was able to see, this is me too. And one old teacher used to point all the time to say, this too is me, and all kinds of things. And Ming did it at the time. Isn't that the hardest moment? It's easy when things are going well. Say, oh yeah, I'm no self, sure, I'm fine. It's when we got the bad review at work. When we just declared bankruptcy, when whatever. The relationship ended. That's where, at this moment, what is the true face of me? And to take that on. Let me say one more thing before I open the floor a little bit. The reason I pointed out that maintain your realization is I love that too, because even that, there's nothing permanent about it. This idea of the genuine response, it's now. We don't get a diploma when we get it. We still got to come up with the next response. The teaching of a lifetime. An appropriate response. Appropriate, by the way, I've had some clients who got caught by that word appropriate, like proper, where I take it to mean like fitting, not anything about proper or not proper. Let me say one more point. I said I was going to make one, and then let me say one last one. Is it the other thing that strikes me of significance about this story? Is the old master said, "I don't know what the head monk's going to do. Run." There was no place within that form to deal with the relationship issues. Now maybe we're doing a little better with it in this country, but I'm not so sure. In terms of Zen practice, anyway. I think some of the other practices do a little, Buddhist practices do a little better in other contemplative forms. But at least in the time of this, it would tell you why there is Zen practice and why there is psychotherapeutic practice. They're not equal, and they don't, they each have a place. Okay, now, up and out.
What was the question?
What do you think?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And here's such an initiation practice, much like going outside of the nature was getting the change of the background, initiation, ritual, and the running, and the changing of the robes, and the role reversals, and you don't know who's who, teacher, student, student's teacher. And there's a lot of motion there in that initiation where things don't get so defined all of a sudden, but the teaching still comes out. And the question of the truth is still pressed upon all of our ears and begged upon us to take the time to slow down our, you know, non-experiential lives and stare at that and perhaps even come up with an answer.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And I'd say, too, that I see in centers today this transmission, not always that pretty. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I was sort of contemplating that these are stories, at least I think these are stories of men.
Mm.
And there's a confrontation.
Mm.
And, you know, the throat, or the threat of grabbing for the throat. And I'm wondering whether two women would relate in this way, or how it would change. I mean, there's a universality, but how this might be a bit gender defined or gender illustrated, and how it might look different. I think that's not something for you and I to
Well, I might say too that when I first joined a Zen monastery some years ago, there were 27 men there and 3 women. It was a much more traditional Japanese form. And one of the reasons I left it was that that's really the tradition that I started in and moved out here to sit with a woman teacher. That really was a little bit different. But it's grown in difference too. But there is that within the tradition from which I speak, but also in the culture as well. So historically, Buddhism was more men than women, too. Though there are stories of Buddhist women.
Yeah, I think more, I'm thinking more in the characterization of it, that confrontation that brings,
yeah, I understand.
Brings this issue to a point where it can be observed. How would that be different? Or would it ever get there?
This is a little bit of an aside. But John Stewart last week, he did a thing about where he had this woman saying, well, what about when women get to be CEO? And they did a bit of a facetious piece where she was taking power like a man. And then they switched it and had her say, but that's not how women would do it. And then she did it psychologically. Like, middle school girls did when my daughter was in middle school, like really getting in to make John Stewart cry. So to your point, we'd probably look completely different. I would certainly believe that.
Yeah. I was visualizing what the interaction between Sean and Will would have been like if Sean had been female. I think it would have been very different.
Absolutely. Interesting point.
Yeah.
Rent that movie.
Yeah.
What does Cohen mean? What's the translation? Is that a direct one? Or what? How would you describe it?
There is, and I don't remember it. Yeah, I don't remember. Anybody remember? Okay. I'll look it up. I probably even have a book with me that I can... The one from Robert Aiken. He might say in that. I'll take a look after. Yeah.
So you might be doing this tomorrow, but you are, seem to be implying the shadow here in this story.
Yes. Well, it's about, I would love to. It's about 10 to 9 now, and we want to stop at 9, right?
Yeah.
That's how it works. I wanted to play one more short film clip and then just have a few minutes to talk. This film clip, too, makes another point I wanted to make. It's of... I don't know what kind of art to tell you this is an artist of. But this is a man with a hip condition, such as hip, I believe, dysplasis. And he's had to adapt a way to move around, to get around. And he adapted it into an art form. And what struck me about it was that we could easily think of this idea of our genuine response as requiring that the circumstances in our world work. That, like, if pottery is my passion, if I don't find a way to do pottery, then I can't do my work. And what I love about this is his finding his way to get around the world with who he is in this body. Thank you. what I see in this, why I wanted to include it, so there's nothing stopping us now from finding, from really being fully present, finding our way to do it. There's no barrier. If this guy can do that, we can find our way. And that fits too with Jung's idea that we all have that inner urge towards individuation. And in Zen, that we all have Buddha nature right now. And the other thing I didn't mention about Ming is, what's the transformation there? There was no transformation but for his seeing himself right now, just as he was. So let me just say, for those who are interested in attending tomorrow, I'm going to go in a little more depth, look for ways for some experiential engagement, and then have a number of ways to try to look at the how part. How do we get to this genuine response? What are the possibilities? And then also address this idea of bias control. And what I mean by that is that if we're looking for, we get that click, that's my answer. What about when we're dead wrong? It happens. How do we check ourselves? So, I'm going to stop here and take some last comments. We got 5 minutes left. If you're interested in doing more with this, there's a lot of ideas I'm not getting to. I'm thinking I may do a class at the Zen Center bringing this forward. Just let me know if you're interested. Yeah.
Well, I just like to say that I you aren't alone in asking that question, because me and the Zen world have been asking it for a very long time. It's an awesome discussion, and
yeah. Other thoughts, other comments? Anyone? Can anyone say anything so that Anne can sleep like a baby? Yeah. Great. I heard it. One of the late night comedians watched a YouTube stand up routine of one of them, I forget, Craig something or other, where he had this thing of taking antidepressants and people saying it's a crutch, and is saying, well, that only addresses the symptoms. He's saying, well, the symptom is of depression is depression, that's why I'm taking this. And you wouldn't say to a one legged man, that's a crutch. Yeah, it's a crutch. Yeah.
Were all three of those examples, did they, I know the two of them had two men in a conflict where their egos were involved and where they enacted some drama in a psychologist's office. Mike, the question that arises in my mind, at times like that, for example, they've run down a mountain. At a time like that, my mind would be boiling with, emotion as well as physical. So at a time like that, is it possible for a person to have their mind stilled and have a numinous experience and have a breakthrough, or is it is that a credible story? After all, it is a story that's written by someone. It's telegraphy, and we're supposed to interpret it however the best we can. I don't know if it's possible. My humanist moments weren't when my heart was pumping and I was in rage, and when I was winning in the Seahawks Super Bowl.
Can you tell me what the is there a question there you can reframe from?
How does a person have a numinous experience when they're in the middle of tripping somebody's throat and the guy says the right thing? Did the guy have a breakthrough then, or did he have something about it later? Did the monk have a breakthrough right on the spot? But I don't know if it's possible for a person to. That doesn't seem credible to me, to have a breakthrough in their understanding.
Well, perhaps all that's important would be what is credible to you in how you do it, and finding your way, that how anybody else would do it would be interesting to watch, but not central. Here it is at 9:00. I just remembered a story with a woman's the protagonist. But we'll have to leave that. I'll tell you what to look up. Penelope, when Odysseus comes home. The challenge that she has in facing Odysseus again is a really great story, too. Sure. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.